Beastie FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Filton Tory MP and Freemason Jack Lopresti changes his story about last December's trip to Saudi Arabia. He didn't meet human rights groups after all, but was representing British arms manufacturers. Plus, the Boston Marathon bombs as cracks start appearing in the story of last Friday's dramatic car chase by the Boston police. But chemical weapons in Syria, is it Iraq all over again? And that's where we'll start this week, Martin. Syria, we just heard an appeal there out on the, just after the news about Syria. All eyes seem to be on the country. I mean, we hear this week a slightly iffy news from the intelligence services in the UK and the US that it looks as if Assad may have used chemical weapons in the last few weeks. They've been having a report, you know, quite a detailed look into it, and they've decided yes, they think he did, but they're not absolutely sure.
Well, the Syrians, of course, say it was the rebels who did it, and the rebels, in fact, did put a video up some months ago showing that they did have access to chemical weapons as part of their strategy of tension with the government there. I don't know. Basically, chemical weapons are not much use for the kind of fighting that's going on in Syria anyway. I mean, you're talking about street fighting. I mean, chemical weapons are not much use for that in any case, whoever may or may not use them. What's important here, of course, is that they're saying that if they use weapons of mass destruction, i.e. chemical weapons, then that's a red line that means we should invade. Which is why, of course, the US has been rather reluctant to come forward and go along with the Israelis, where this story originated. Because, of course, they've then backed themselves into a corner where they've got to invade Syria. Now, in actual fact, of course, Syria is a tragic civil war. The Christians, the Druze, and the Alawites and the Shiites are backing the government, and the Sunni insurgency is being backed by the West and by the Saudi Arabia. We'll perhaps come to talk about Saudi role in all of this in a minute. But it's certainly not a straightforward situation with an unarmed population being gunned down by the evil government. The government's probably pretty evil, but the people fighting them are pretty evil. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia at the height of the war there, and you know what? I've got news for people. There were no good guys. Everybody was misbehaving. It's rather usual in wars. You'll see also that British soldiers are being charged at the moment with carrying out tortures and assassinations inside Iraq. Are we good guys or bad guys? So, in wartime, we're all bad guys.
Well, with this announcement about... Well, it wasn't really a proper announcement at all. It was a kind of half announcement where they said, we think there might have been, and it looks as if they've crossed the red line. But it's absolutely unclear as to who actually used these chemical weapons, if they were used.
Well, indeed, and the Syrian government are saying, no, it wasn't us that used them, it's the rebels who used them and then tried to blame us. And, of course, there is evidence that the rebels are doing things like massacring supporters of the government and then claiming that the government has massacred their own supporters. Both sides are engaged in a kind of psychological warfare, manipulation of public opinion.
But you can't
be... We can be sure that the people of Syria are suffering. So the appeal by the DEC earlier for people to aid them is perfectly legitimate. People are dying and suffering for sure. The question is, of course, it's not as simple as people would like it to be, with bad guys on one side and good guys on the other. The al-Nusra Front operating in Syria has openly proclaimed their allegiance to al-Qaeda, who are supposed... In fact, many al-Qaeda groups around the world are funded by the West. They always were, like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was the Schwerpunkt of the attack on Tripoli in the last years. So I think what's happened over Syria is that the simplistic narrative has gradually been worn away by reality as people realise, no, this is actually a god-awful mess and that there isn't actually a simple solution, and certainly splattering the place with loads of British and US high explosive is not actually going to add to anybody's happiness.
US Defence Secretary Chuck Hagel, who was on a visit to the United Arab Emirates, told reporters on Thursday that Washington has evidence the chemical weapon sarin has been used in Syria on a small scale. Our intelligence community does assess with varying varying degrees of confidence that the Syrian regime has used chemical weapons on a small scale in Syria, specifically the chemical agent sarin, Hagel said. We need all the facts. We need all the information, he said, adding, what I've just given you is what our intelligence community has said they know. As I also said, they are still assessing and they are still looking at what happened, who was responsible, and the other specifics that we'll need. Now, this does all sound a little bit similar to the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003, with the allegations of weapons of mass destruction there. Have we got any more confidence that there are weapons of mass destruction being used, not in this case by Saddam, but by Assad?
Well, the problem that the Western powers have got is that if you start telling lies and get found out, when you're telling the truth, nobody believes you. And in actual fact, what the US Secretary of Defense says and his intelligence services, I'm inclined to discount completely. Because basically what intelligence services do, they don't find things out, they tell fibs. That's what they're there for. So you just take it with a massive pinch of salt. I don't believe what the Assad regime says either. Don't believe what anybody says, and then you're probably right.
Staying with Syria, magnetic bomb kills the Syrian electricity ministry official. The car bombing was carried out on Wednesday in al-Baramake district in the capital Damascus and killed Mohammed Abdul Wahab Hassan, who's the director of the qualification and training department of the electricity ministry. A senior official at the electricity ministry was killed by a magnetic bomb attached to his car by the foreign-backed militants in the Arab country. Is this really just rebels doing this kind of thing, Martin?
Who knows? I mean, we're sitting here in a studio in Bristol.
I mean, it seems like this guy has been specifically targeted, hasn't he?
Yes, well, what seems to be happening is anybody who works for the Syrian government is being regarded as a supporter of the regime, you know, including postmen, teachers and so on. I mean, I don't really know what's going on. Most people don't. But the idea that there's just a bad government and good rebels rebelling against them strikes me as inherently implausible. Wars are very, very messy. And that's why you shouldn't get into them.
Of course, what
should be happening in Saudi Arabia, which we may come to discuss in a minute, what if there was an armed rebellion in Saudi Arabia and government officials, because they don't have any elections in Saudi Arabia, were starting to be killed by the rebels? Should we be cheering that on as we're cheering them on in Syria? Of course, we wouldn't be cheering them on because they're our bad guys. And the point is the double standards of the West in relation to all of this just makes the rest of the world basically think that we just tell lies and that we don't really know, you know, that the West basically, you know, nobody takes us seriously when it comes to questions.
Now, Respect MP George Galloway yesterday evening is saying, mark my words, we are on the verge of a general Middle East war. Hold on to your hats and your heads everywhere. This war will be triggered by the Crusaders, the hypocrites who massacred people with nuclear, chemical and biological weapons against the Native Americans in Japan, Vietnam, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon and their satrapies, whatever that means, in the Arab world. It will be resisted by Russia, China, Iran, Iraq, the majority in Lebanon, Palestine. That's what I mean by a general war. The sectarian poison has been injected. The WMD lie has been launched. The touch paper has been lit. The explosions will be unlimited by space and time. Now, that's a bit of a prophet of doom, George Galloway, but I mean, you know, is there any actual reality to what he's saying here?
I think there is, and all we have to do is listen to what the Israeli government is saying, listen to what the US government is saying. They are saying, we want a war in the Middle East, and if we can't have one in Syria, we want one in Iran. And of course, we also want to get rid of the Hezbollah-backed government in Lebanon, and we also want to do something about Iraq, because of course you've got a Shia-based government there, which is aligned with Iran, which was the result of their last intervention. I mean, you should listen to what these people are saying. The US and the Israelis are openly calling, we want a major war. People should listen to them. They're going to have one. We're going to have one. And of course, that will crash the economy. It'll be devastating for humanity. And the people in charge, frankly, will eventually have to go to some kind of Nuremberg trial or put up against a wall and shot like in Libya.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, staying in the Middle East, not Syria this time, but in Saudi Arabia, the Syria's Fraud Office, this is Exaro News story, is poised to drop an investigation into claims of Saudi bribes. Investigation has been left for dead, says a Syria's Fraud Office insider. Investigators at the Syria's Fraud Office are prepared to drop their investigation into allegations of bribery surrounding a contract to overhaul Saudi Arabia's military communications. A key SFO insider told Exaro News that Director David Green was working out how to manage the politically sensitive decision to drop the investigation, saying it had already been left for dead and was gathering dust. The move's bound to trigger fresh accusations from the international community that the UK is failing to take bribery in overseas trade seriously, Martin.
Yes, and of course the bribery by the British companies actually impacts on US companies, so that's why they're a bit concerned about this.
But the Serious Fraud Office is investigating people who are breaking the law in Britain, and actually now being told, there's another story this week in The Independent on Tuesday by Oliver Wright, saying that George Osborne has a secret veto on fraud inquiries. George Osborne's got a secret veto over large and potentially politically sensitive fraud investigations. I wonder if this is one that they're bearing in mind when they're writing this article. Under a government agreement, the Serious Fraud Office must get permission from the Treasury to launch any complex new inquiry which comes on top of its normal budget. Controversially, the Treasury can keep its decisions secret, potentially allowing it to veto politically sensitive fraud inquiries after either before or midway through an investigation with no public scrutiny. Ministers have now become the final arbiters of which major financial crimes are investigated as a result of 25% cuts to the SFO's budget over the last 3 years.
Well, I mean, we're talking about bribery here, but let's talk about the regime in Saudi Arabia, which nobody voted for, was imposed by Western colonialists in the 1920s, and the Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Corporation, has been in operation there for many years. What happens in Bahrain, for example, where the Saudis came over the border and started bulldozing Shia mosques at gunpoint and shooting people? That's like the invasion of Czechoslovakia or the invasion of Hungary. What did we do? We didn't even protest. Are we going to cut off arms and arms to Saudi Arabia? Of course not. It keeps filtering in overtime. But of course, ultimately, Saudi patriots will fight for freedom in their country. And of course, anybody who's on the other side are legitimate targets, just like in Syria. Blow their heads off. Car bomb them, assassinate them. That's our policy, isn't it, in Syria? Well, maybe it's our policy in Saudi Arabia as well. Maybe Jack Lepressi might have got unlucky and come back with half a leg or his head blown off, like British soldiers in Afghanistan. If you go to dangerous places, dangerous things can happen to you.
Well, this is you're referring to the article in Private Eye this week. Another gaggle of Tory MPs has paid a friendly visit to the authoritarian Saudi government, according to the latest register of MPs' interests. This is the second recent Tory trip to Saudi after four Tory MPs went on a shindig with the sheikhs. That's that Private Eye language, the shindig with the sheikhs, in December. In February, I-1334 pointed out apparent areas in the way one of them, Filton MP Jack Lepresti, described his trip. Lepresti's entry in the MP's register failed to mention that it was arranged by the UK Defence Forum, an arms industry funded group. Lepresti also claimed to have met various human rights groups, which seemed unlikely at the time, but Lepresti's now corrected his entry. He now acknowledges the role of the UK Defence Forum, and all mention of human rights groups has gone.
Well, he was caught out, wasn't he? I mean, it's the Al-Yamamar defence deal was the biggest defence deal in history. It's supplying high-tech weaponry to the Saudi state, where all 19...
But that's decades ago.
No, but at the same time, don't forget, illegal activity is illegal. And if we're going to send people to prison for a year and a half for stealing a bottle of water, what do we do when they do something illegal involving millions of pounds and weaponry? We don't have the death penalty anymore in this country, do we? But it's that sort of level, isn't it?
Now, you mentioned Bahrain briefly there. Now, we do have the Bahraini Grand Prix just coming up this weekend. Cancelled UN visit shows Bahrain is not serious about human rights. This is Amnesty International now. Bahrain is clearly not serious about implementing human rights reforms, Amnesty said, after the Gulf Kingdom cancelled a planned visit by the United Nations torture expert for a second time. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, said he was deeply disappointed after Bahrain postponed next month's visit, citing delays and ongoing national dialogue. The Bahraini authorities also cancelled a visit by him in February 2012, claiming they were still undergoing major reforms. This latest cancellation shows that Bahrain is not serious about implementing human rights reforms. The authorities have used the buzzword of reform as a smokescreen, when in reality they're not reforming, said Hasiba Haj Saruti, Amnesty International's Middle East and North African Deputy Director.
Yes, and of course we're not being banged over the head night after night by how terrible the regime in Bahrain is, because they're on our side and the US Fifth Fleet is based there and they're probably going to be used as a major base for attacking Iran. So let's talk about Syria instead.
Hosting Formula One is a point of pride for Bahrain's rulers, who pay an estimated $40 million a year for the privilege. An image of the circuit is on the country's half dinar note.
Yes, and of course, I mean, I understand that the opposition in Bahrain is quite committed to non-violence, unlike the opposition in Syria or Libya, it might be said. But if they weren't committed to non-violence, and there's no particular reason why they should be, what I say to anybody going into a Formula One race at Bahrain next week is, if you don't come back because somebody blows you up or shoots you, then you've only got yourself to blame, haven't you? Because we all believe in bloody revolution in Syria, don't we? And in Libya, Gaddafi was shot in the head and bayoneted up his backside on YouTube, and the West cheered. And the same thing could happen to people, Tory MPs or Formula One people, who go and give comfort to regimes which have no democratic legitimacy. Well, I'm afraid it's, revolutions are bloody affairs, aren't they?
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
On to the Boston Marathon bombs, and the classmates, the bomb suspect, was on campus this week. This is the Associated Press. Boston Marathon bombing suspect Jokhar Tsarnaev was at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth during the week last week after the explosives killed three people and wounded more than 180 others, his classmates told the Associated Press. Students said Tsarnaev lived on the third floor of the Pinedale dormitory. Harry Danso lives on the same floor, told the Associated Press. He saw him in the dorm half hallway this week after the bombings. He was regular, he was calm, said Danso, who described Tsarnaev as a quiet kid who would sometimes ask him for a homework assignment. Now, Martin, does seem a little bit strange if he's on the run, supposedly, that he should actually be at his college campus, this bombing suspect.
Well, it's also very strange that he's definitely had contact with the FBI and the CIA, although they denied it at first. I mean, more things come out day by day about this, but frankly, given what we know about the FBI and the CIA and the way they run things, virtually everybody arrested and charged, including the underpants bomber and the shoe bomber, had been run by intelligence agents, Western intelligence agencies. So if we suspect that there's something fishy about the Boston bombing, that's absolutely par for the course. We're still getting all the information, but it pretty much looks to me as if this is a standard Western intelligence false flag attack of the kind that, like the bombing of Bologna railway station, which nobody disputes was carried out ultimately by NATO intelligence services. Not that you'll hear that on Radio 4 or the BBC.
Well, there was the Gladio program
back in 1993. People have got to put context around this. There's a history of Western intelligence services engaging in terrorism in order to create enemies within, in order to boost up the budgets for the homeland security and all the rest of it. Now, we've still got an open mind about it, but I think what they found about the Boston incident is that everybody is watching like hawks now. I've seen masses of video footage and film from the incidents, and for example, people through crowdsourcing out on the internet have already identified Kraft International as a private security firm, with all of their people crawling around the place where the bombs went off, including a guy who seems to have lost his backpack, which seems to have been the bomb. And of course, these other chaps that they've blamed for this, one of them is dead, and there's also conflicting stories about how they died, and the chap that they've captured apparently can't talk to anybody, but now he is talking to some. Do you know that, in fact, there's another really interesting fact, that the hospital where they're treating him, they've actually got Israeli doctors and all sorts of...
Well, why shouldn't they have Israeli doctors?
Well, why shouldn't they? It's just a question, isn't it? It's just a question. Okay. Why Israeli doctors? Why not doctors from Boston? I mean, the point is that the world no longer believes the stories that Western governments tell about incidents like this. And they've only got themselves to blame because they've been caught out with lies so often, so frequently over the years, and there's absolutely cast iron evidence that they've been involved in terrorism in the past. People just put Gladio into a search engine and it will all come up, and it's not disputed. They themselves don't even dispute that. They just try and ignore it. We are right to be suspicious of the government.
Well, the suspects are still, despite what you say, Martin, Jokhar Tsarnaev and Tamerlan Tsarnaev. Tamerlan apparently was killed, at least that's what we were told, but the bombing suspect didn't engage in a shootout with police or shoot himself. He didn't and wasn't even armed when hiding in the boat. This is
yes, and we were told that they did have a shootout. Now, you either did or didn't have a shootout, and you'd have thought if you hadn't had a shootout, you'd know, wouldn't you? So there was a shootout, and then there wasn't a shootout. Now, what's going on here?
Now, the local TV, who were actually on the scene, this is last Friday morning, or Thursday night, just about a week ago, were saying that the suspect, Jokhar, he was actually stripped naked and put into a police car. But then we were later told that he'd been killed. So let's have a little listen to that report now from local TV in Boston, actually at literally just a few minutes after this incident with the cars last Thursday night, Friday morning.
All had their weapons drawn, pointing at a vehicle that we could not see from our vantage point. They were screaming for somebody. to put his hands up to get out of the car. At some point, he did do that. Because then we could tell that the officers were relaxing. We still couldn't see the car or the suspect. Then at some point, they brought him from his vehicle to a police car. He was completely naked. He'd been, during the confrontation, I did hear him, and I believe you may be able to hear this on the tape we shot. They were ordering him to remove all his clothes, including his underwear. It was clear.
You heard the police officer say, remove all your clothes.
Yes.
Remove your skivvies.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So that's when they brought him completely naked into a police car.
Was he in handcuffs?
I believe he was cuffed, yes. He's been escorted. Put in the car. So about 10 or 15 minutes ago, the FBI arrived.
So, yes, and at which point the FBI arrived and took over, but that was the local police having arrested him, Martin. Now, it does sound pretty suspicious if he was handcuffed and naked, how he could then put up enough resistance to the police to be shot and killed.
It does, doesn't it? And I think all of these anomalies are coming out. The internet, in fact, has actually allowed people to question these events much more closely than they previously did. More information is coming out all the time. Everything I've seen so far suggests to me that this is a standard false flag operation by Western intelligence.
Now, false flag, apparently, Google have been saying that more people in the United States have been Googling this term false flag than ever before.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Well, basically, it's a term from 18th century naval warfare originally, where ships, of course, you don't know what a ship, whether a ship's on your side or not, depending on what flag they're flying. So you basically fly the flag of your enemy, get right up close, and it turns out, and then you open fire on them when they're at least expecting it. So that's where it originally comes from. But of course, what we're really talking about is carrying out acts of terror or violence, which are then blamed on other people, like the burning of the Reichstag in Germany, which was blamed on the communists, which was probably carried out by the Nazis.
What was the importance of this Reichstag being burned?
The Reichstag being burned was supposedly an attack upon the German state. It was the communists were blamed, and the communists were then all rounded up and sent off to concentration camps in the 30s. But most historians are now firmly of the opinion that the attack was carried out by the Nazis themselves and blamed on the communists. So this is a standard technique. It's not just that Western intelligence services engage in it, but they do. They definitely do. There's a very interesting book, NATO's Secret Armies, by Daniel Ganzer, who is a top academic in Switzerland. And also, of course, there's the Gladio documentaries that were on BBC Two in 1993, made by Frankovich, where all of this stuff is documented. And it's not conspiracy theory. This is all historical fact that the Western intelligence services do engage in these kind of provocations. The question is Boston such provocation? My provisional answer is yes.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Another bit of news this week. A Freedom of Information request has revealed that George Osborne was at the 2011 Bilderberg meeting in an official capacity because it's appeared on the Treasury's official list of engagements as a PDF file on the Treasury website has been disclosed. Martin, what is the problem with... I mean, Bilderberg conferences aren't all that well known. They're very secretive. They started just after the Second World War. The initial chairman was Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, who was an ex-SS officer. And the idea was to bring Europe and America together, the NATO countries together in a political way, but for everyone to speak in a personal capacity and off the record. So how can George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, in charge of all our tax money, be in that meeting in a personal capacity and an official capacity at the same time?
Well, what he said at the time when he was questioned about going to Bilderberg, he said, I was in there as a personal capacity, but as we know, and we knew at the time, he was taking his Treasury officials with him who were on the British taxpayers' wage. And basically, if Treasury officials go to a meeting, I want to know what the minutes of that meeting are, because I'm paying for this. And of course, Bilderberg were named by Francesco Imposimosto, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, in a recent book, as the real perpetrators of terrorism in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s. That's the head of the Italian Supreme Court. Bilderberg are the terrorists. You don't hear that on Radio 4, do you?
Well, they'll be meeting in Watford, in Hertfordshire, in June. No doubt we'll be covering it on here, even though, you know, it's difficult to know how much other parts of the British mainstream media will cover it. We certainly will. But it looks like, I mean, it's not 100% certain because they don't give out the details until the actual conference is closing or is taking place. So it's always a little bit of guesswork beforehand. And certainly people will be coming over from the US. But Martin, one person that won't be coming this year is Jim Tucker. He's a veteran reporter on the Bilderberg conferences from American Free Press. And here he is now, though, explaining a little bit about the conferences and why it's actually a criminal offence in the United States for any politician, US politician, to attend such an event.
I don't hate the Bilderberg guys. It's just sneering contempt for those international criminals. Incidentally, every American who participates is committing a crime, is a criminal in violation of the Logan Act. Under the Logan Act, Americans, individuals, can have a meeting, a group meeting, with fellow employees. But it's got to be open. People have to be able to observe. Maybe not ask questions, but just the public has to be allowed to sit in and observe such meetings. If those meetings are closed, it's illegal. So a lot of apologists say, well, the Logan Act was passed in 1798, one of the first acts of the first Congress. Good works are done in sunshine. Evil is done within the cover of darkness. That's why they meet at night.
Well, this is the U.S. Congress passed this thing called the Logan Act, Martin, almost as soon as the American Republic was formed, and as part of their constitution. They were saying basically that no government official is allowed to go to private meetings like this Bilderberg meeting at all, and if they do, it's a criminal offence. So it seems that there is a sort of culture of impunity has built up around this meeting so that the government officials can go there in this official capacity. But, I mean, and what he's saying, though, would it be realistic for members of the public to be allowed to sit and listen and earwig into these big top-level private, so-called private meetings that have this public element with public officials in there too?
Well, if the public officials are in there, then there should be a minute taken, and there may be reasons for why you shouldn't know what happened in that meeting for, say, 30 years or whatever, but the point is that it should be minuted, and if there is a legitimate reason for it to be kept secret, it should be kept secret. What we saw with Osborne was, A, I think he pretended that he hadn't gone at all, then he said, yes, I did go, but in a personal capacity, and now we found he didn't go in a personal capacity, went with his Treasury officials. Now, if he's gone there with Treasury officials, as far as I'm concerned, that is something that the British public have a right to know what is being decided in the meeting. Now, what Bilderberg are just part of a series of groups which actually, you know, determine Western policy. There's also the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, and no doubt there are other groups whose names we do not know. But of course, most policy is decided at the top in secret, and then run out to the proles for the rest of us to find out after the event. But of course, Bilderberg for many years pretended it didn't exist, and of course, eventually people like Jim Tucker forced them into the open, and they just don't like publicity because. They just don't like it.
Well, one of the reasons they don't like it is because quite a lot of the media people are in there too. I mean, for example, we've got this guy Marcus Aegeus, the chairman of Barclays, former chairman of Barclays, who then pretended to leave but didn't leave and carried on as chairman, even though he gave an announcement to the press that he was leaving. And he is also an executive director of the BBC, so he's one of the top BBC people who meets with the director general, you know, pretty much weekly on a weekly basis, on, you know, as a daily manager. And yet he's in there too. So there is some kind of, you know, surely if you're part of a media organisation and you're at a meeting, there is a problem if you then simply don't report that kind of thing at all.
Exactly, that's one of the things about being invited.
But they're sworn to secrecy.
First thing about Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. But I just reiterate that the head of the Italian Supreme Court has recently published a book saying that Bilderberg were behind the terrorism in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s. And he knows that because he works with the Italian police force, who have investigated it. This is not the sort of thing you're going to hear in the mainstream. As you pointed out, the BBC are invited inside the Bilderberg fence, which is why they pretended for many years that it never took place. But bit by bit, we are dragging these people into the light.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Day in the UK, terror plot leaders were jailed in Birmingham, this bomb for a Birmingham bomb plan today. Irfan Nasir, 31, was sentenced to life with a minimum of 18 years. Irfan Khalid, 28, was given 18 years. And Ashik Ali was sentenced to 15 years. The judge said Nasir wanted to turn part of Birmingham into a little war zone. Eight other members of the terrorist cell will be sentenced later. The group had planned to set off up to eight bombs in rucksacks using timers to detonate the charges. Detectives believe the terror plot is the most significant to be uncovered since the 2006 conspiracy to blow up transatlantic airliners using bombs disguised as soft drinks. Lots of things the judge said about these people, but Martin, what bothers me is that actually they hadn't got any targets, they hadn't got any bomb-making equipment. Really, this was, you know, they had raised some money, but this was almost all talk. It wasn't actually any kind of specifics to do with a capability to actually carry out an attack.
Well, that's true, although what I would say about this is it was the evidence was presented to a jury. Now, juries do sometimes get things wrong.
Well, this is one of the things
that... I mean, I'm more prepared to listen to the police when they put it in front of a jury properly.
Well, there are two Crown Courts in the country that have got lots of military people who live in the area who sit on juries. One is Portsmouth and the other one is Woolwich Crown Court. So if this is a terror plot in Birmingham, why can't they have a Birmingham jury make a decision?
Well, that is an issue. The other issue, of course, is that even when you've got genuine terrorists, you then have to ask yourself the question, well, who's pulling the strings of these terrorists? I see the judge said, you were working for Al-Qaeda, and you claim to be working... Now, Al-Qaeda was set up under Operation Cyclone by the Western Intelligence Services to infiltrate jihadi fighters, terrorists, whatever you want to call them, into Afghanistan in the 1980s. And everybody knows this. Again, it's historical fact, not conspiracy theory. So the question is, who are Al-Qaeda? Are Al-Qaeda, in fact, our own intelligence services who are recruiting misguided people to be terrorists and then arresting them and then saying, oh, look, we've caught these terrorists. Certainly everybody that's been arrested in the US up to now for terrorism has actually been set up by the FBI, and they thought they were joining Al-Qaeda and being given bomb-making equipment and so on, and they were basically being tricked. Although in the 1993 bombing in the World Trade Center, which was clearly an FBI plot from start to finish, they actually allowed them to blow up the bomb and kill six people and then arrested them all. Now, This is what people have got to understand. Even when people are arrested, who are genuinely bad people who are trying to do bad things, you've got to ask yourself the question, who put them up to it? And frequently, it is in fact a setup. And that, of course, the purpose of the setup is not just to put them in prison, it's to terrify the population and to bring in, you know, whatever measures the secret security state
wants. Well, that's certainly one of the things that some of the family members of the alleged Boston bomb suspects have been saying about their children. They actually do believe that these children have been set up. Anyway, Khalid, who was one of the Birmingham people sentenced today, had been found to be at the bottom 2-5% in terms of cognitive ability. But one thing is absolutely certain about this case, it was actually the local Muslim community that flagged them up to the police in the first place.
Exactly, and if you remember when I spoke at Birmingham Central Mosque some years ago, that's what I stressed to people. If they've got any information, give it to the local police, but not to the intelligence service, because they frankly are suspects.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
And the world just got a little bit lighter because Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth is joining us. Hi, Mike.
Good evening.
Now, what is the carbon bubble? This is something, a little term I've been reading over the last few weeks.
Yeah.
What is the carbon bubble?
Yeah. Well, there's been another report about this last week. Bubbles are things that are kind of fairly well known throughout the history of economics, starting, I believe, with tulip bulbs in the 17th century and... most recent example being the overinflation of house prices.
Housing bubble. They're constantly pumping it up, even at the moment, aren't they? The government have George Osborne's just introduced this thing to sort of help people borrow more money to buy houses when they can't afford it. Well, actually, of course, that is something that plays into the hands of the house builders. It's really what the house builders want, because they're building, they're selling houses at a far too expensive price, and they want people to be able to pay that expensive price. But anyway, sorry, carry on with the carbon bubble.
Well, the carbon bubble, it's carrying on a historic trend, but it threatens to be perhaps the most spectacularly overinflated bubble of all, because what's happening is that we've got some idea of the limits that we're approaching in terms of how much more stress we can put on the climate by burning carbon, burning more fossil fuels, adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And we understand that, you know, there are limits are approaching that we can't afford to go over, because, you know, the situation and the degree of climate destabilization that you get is just too dangerous. And you compute against that the amount of fossil fuels there are actually available in reserves that we already know about. It's about five times more than we can afford to burn. So clearly what's happening is that the major oil companies are, coal companies are sitting on huge amounts of assets that actually aren't assets at all, because if they were burnt, you know, it would tip the world climate into such a destabilized state that the consequences politically and economically.
But I mean, surely they are thinking, well, this is great for us, because this scarcity and the fact that we're not allowed to burn these things means the price is going to go up. And actually, we're sitting on an asset which they're looking at into thousands of years, possibly into the future. This is going to keep paying for them, even though actually it's just a natural resource.
I don't see how they can imagine that they're actually going to be sitting on a reserve that is worth anything if it's not physically advisable to burn it. But I think the consequence really is more what it means in terms of our politics now. So you've got these oil companies and the coal companies, basically, and all the people that are invested in them, all gambling on the fact that the world's governments won't take meaningful steps to limit carbon emissions, because if that did happen, their assets become worthless. So you're creating a huge, I mean, you know, obviously the fossil fuel companies are big. Oil and coal companies represented vested interests anyway, but you're now creating a huge new motivation for the vested interests to try and undermine world governments ever reaching any agreement on climate change.
Okay. Now, what about railways? Are we going to have some more railways? I noticed Richard Cottrell's just coming out with his book at the moment about beaching, and how actually he was totally flawed when he closed the railways down in the 1960s. Don't you think that will actually make quite a bit of difference? And is Friends of the Earth campaigning for that? Because, I mean, we've had stories today about First Bus and they're refusing to allow CND to put adverts on their buses. And obviously, you know, people out there sitting in jams at 6:30 tonight, you know, we don't want so many cars around. It's rather galling to hear that beaching back in the 1960s closed down a network which actually could have been taking us backwards and forwards at a very affordable price from home. Even if our home is a little way away from the local railway station, it's still a possibility of leaving your bike there and doing the last mile by bike or something like that. I mean, isn't actually this one of the big reasons that we're so hooked on oil today?
Well, I don't know. I can't claim any expertise into what the motivations were for beaching closing down so much of the rail network. You know, it's sort of nearly 50 years ago now. But
is it almost exactly 50 years?
Actually, there are bits of it left that could be brought back into productive use. And here in Bristol, indeed, we have got the makings, the infrastructure, that would give us quite a good suburban railway system.
Now, hasn't the Severn Beach Line been actually quite a success? I mean, there's been a lot of pressure put on the operators. I think it's First Group again.
It is.
You know, in a way, I wonder whether these lines couldn't be run like kind of heritage lines or by private businesses, small businesses, you know, in order to get them back into service. Why don't we see so much of that? Because Portishead is an obvious one.
Yes.
It's a growing town. There's loads of new development in Portishead, and yet you cannot catch a train from Portishead to Bristol, even though there's a railway line.
Though there's a railway there, yes, that's right. Indeed, I think we should be looking at better models for ownership of the rail network and community, you know, stakeholders actually having a chance to own bits of the rail network. But you know, the possibilities are for Bristol to have a very good functioning suburban rail network, which links, as you say, you know, Portishead, the Severn Beach Line, but also joining up the loop that goes from St Andrews Road through Henbury up towards Filton. So we've got there, you know, potentially a very good system. And you know, bits of it now sort of being proposed to come back into operation, but still not actually closing that loop. So there is a campaign.
So what stops that happening? I mean, you know, it's been proved successful on the Severn Beach. So why, you know, why are we still not being able to catch a train from Portishead into town and back again? I mean, there must be people really frustrated having to do that commute every day.
Yes, it is indeed extremely frustrating. What are the reasons for it? I'm not so close to it these days. I can tell you when I was more close to transport issues, what I observed was a complete inertia on the part of civil servants in national government and local politicians who just kind of thought that reopening and reinstating rail services was something that was difficult and too complicated, and they couldn't possibly
do it. Also, don't people see it maybe as a step back? You know, this is it. It's almost like the momentum is to close the railways. But actually, you know, that is it's counterintuitive, but maybe we should be doing the opposite.
I don't know what the mindset was, but, you know, you had the living examples just across the estuary over in Wales. You could see, you know, new stations opening, new trains coming into service, improvements in rail service being organised by local authorities and local communities, and why couldn't we do the same thing here?
Well, this is the test for George, isn't it? Mr Ferguson, now you're in charge, mate, you know, sort it out. Anyway, another big local issue, which you are more involved with, sorry to spring all that stuff about the railways on you there, is EDF and Hinkley Point and the update. Now, the thing that I always remind us about Hinkley Point is we are actually downwind of Hinkley. So if either, you know, God forbid, some tsunami comes down the Bristol Channel, or some terrorist lunatic crashes a plane into Hinkley Point, we are going to be on the receiving end of all that fallout. So what is going on with the development of this new power station at Hinkley, which I understand, I think EDF, the French company, are just on their own now in proposing to build it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's interesting you mention about the risk factors associated with it. The proposal now for the new power station at Hinkley would involve storing high-level radioactive waste on that site for over 100 years. It's different from the current generation of power stations.
So why is that? I mean, at the moment, apparently it goes into the fuel rods. When they come out of the reactor, they go into a giant pond, and they sit in there for a year while they cool down, and then they go onto a train and they come through Temple Meads on a Wednesday or something and up to Sellafield. Don't stand too close to the platform when one of those things goes by, folks. You know, really nasty sort of prickly feeling comes out of these flasks. But so they're saying now that the whatever's coming out of the new reactor is going to have to sit in a pond for how long, Mike?
Well, we're talking about a century, basically. It's because
it must be pretty hot.
It's a different technology. It's in terms of the profitability of the industry, it's a way of getting some more money out of the amount of uranium that you burn, but you do create a more radioactive product as a result. So it's too hot to move. So we are in effect looking, people are talking about, you know, this as though it's like for like, it's replacing power stations that are closing down with new ones, but that's not what is on the cards for Somerset. It's a major new nuclear facility, a sort of mini Sellafield, if you like, on the Somerset coast that is going to have high level radioactive waste stored on it for 100 years.
So are they actually going to be doing any kind of reprocessing of this, as they like to call it, you know, where they're pulling out all the plutonium out of it, or are they going to be sending it up to Sellafield after 100 years?
It's always been the dream of the nuclear industry that you can do this kind of reprocessing, and it's a dream that's never come true. It's been a nightmare. You know, the plant in Sellafield that was opened in the 1980s has never produced any useful product and never been economically viable. So it's the dream of the nuclear industry that you can create this kind of ongoing loop that you just keep on taking stuff out of the fuel and bunging it back in the reactor. It's technically and economically proved impossible to bring them out.
Oh, really? But they do get plutonium out of this stuff, don't they?
Well, the initial nuclear reactors that were built in the UK were deliberately designed to generate plutonium, and that was for use in Britain's nuclear weapon, or the joint British-US nuclear weapons programme. But the subsequent generations of reactors have created different product which hasn't proved so amenable to reprocessing in any way.
Yeah, and all nasty stuff. I mean, you know, they have all sorts of horrendous elements, man-made elements that suddenly appear after a nuclear reaction in these things. But anyway, a bit of news from the world nuclear news this week. UK swaps plutonium to balance MOX policies. A series of exchanges has seen the UK take control of 3 tonnes of plutonium it had been storing for foreign firms. The country
country's goal is to use plutonium stocks as reactor fuel for power generation. Having embarked on a national nuclear energy and research programme in the 1950s, the UK has over time separated and recovered plutonium from its used reactor fuel. The largest and most recent plant, Thorpe, also undertook reprocessing for utility customers in Europe and Japan. Stockpiles of the resulting UK and foreign plutonium are all stored at Sellafield. Today, the British government announced it has simplified arrangements for managing these stocks with a series of swaps. The UK will take over 750 kilos of plutonium belonging to German utilities, 1,850 kilos loaned from France, and 350 kilos from Dutch utility EPZ. At the same time, 650 kilos of plutonium stored at Sellafield was transferred from German to Japanese ownership. Now, I can remember, I mean, we seem to be the sort of nuclear waste dumping place for the whole world. I can remember one of the Japanese ships being sent over here, and then actually someone saying, actually, you haven't done all the right paperwork, and it was then sent away again. So what is the point of the stockpiling of plutonium, Mike? Because this new reactor they're planning to build at Hinkley, is it going to be using plutonium or not?
No, it would use enriched uranium fuel as the previous generation of nuclear reactors.
So what's the point of having stockpiling all this, these tons and tons of this plutonium?
It's against a technology that doesn't yet exist to usefully use that.
So what they're saying is we think in the future this stuff might be useful to make nuclear power, and so that's why they're stockpiling it.
That would be one of the purposes. Yes, it could be used in what's called a mixed oxide fuel. So you would have plutonium in there as well as uranium. But as far as I'm aware, what's proposed for Hinkley Point is just burning enriched uranium.
Okay, back to Hinkley, because there's been a bit of a change, hasn't there, this week with EDF deciding that they are not prepared to keep spending the money to stay on site. What's the significance of that?
Yeah. Well, who knows? EDF are crazy situation where the electricity industry is supposedly privatised, but what we have is a utility that is 85% state-owned by the French government, already subsidised by the French government, in negotiation with the UK government to get subsidy from us as well, from our electricity payers. There's no doubt there's a game of brinkmanship going on, because the EDF are pressing the government to guarantee the price that they get from any electricity they generate for the next 40, 50 years, and at a very high price, at a price that is kind of way over what you would currently pay for gas generated from, for electricity generated from gas, say, or indeed from wind power. That's what EDF is sticking out for. They say that the government wants them to go ahead with Hinkley Point, then that's the kind of contract they've got to sign up to. And it could be part of the brinkmanship that they're playing now with the Treasury, principally, that they're saying, okay, so we're not going to keep our presence on the site. They've had a workforce and a presence on the site, kind of on the assumption that they're going to go ahead and be allowed to build they are now allowed, though on the assumption that they are going to be able to afford to build a third power station at Hinkley, and now they're sort of scaling back, and so people are being laid off at the Hinkley site, and the scale of work is being scaled down.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, is this one of the final nails in the coffin for this project of building a nuclear power station at Hinkley? EDF pulling out there, I think they're spending millions of pounds a week there, and they've decided that they've had enough.
Well, I think that is always going to be the way. As you pointed out, they've got subsidy from the French government and they're asking subsidy from the British government. And the line was that we can do this within budget and all the rest of it. Clearly they can't. I mean, what you've got in France, because they've got such a high dependence on nuclear power, is that it's like an addicted heroin addict. They've got to sell more heroin on to cover the costs that they've already sunk in getting addicted to it in the first place. So, it's like pyramid selling. But I think in these times in particular of austerity, it's hard to justify subsidising nuclear power, isn't it?
Mike, just remind us of how to get in touch with Southwest Friends of the Earth, and if you're meeting soon, what it's about and where.
Well, the big meetings we've got coming up are around Bristol Big Green Week, which is going to be the 15th to 23rd of June. We've got a number of events that we're participating in there, and the major one is we're taking part in a solar energy weekend, which is the appropriately enough, around the 21st of June, the sunniest day of the year, or at least the longest day of the year. May not turn out to be the sunniest one. And that weekend, so 21st through to 23rd of June, there'll be a whole series of events down on College Green themed around solar energy for communities, some events for children, events for would-be solar entrepreneurs, people who want to learn how to get their hands on and on the kit and make their own solar installations. So that will all be going on College Green the weekend 21st 23rd of June.
And how to contact you, Mike?
Well, the best way is just to go to bristolfo.org.uk on the web, or our phone number is 0117 942 0128.
Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
And to finish with this week, we've got in between this show and the next show is the 30th of April. That's Walpurgisnacht, one of the scariest nights of the year. And I was rather dismayed to see that over the last year or so, the BBC have pulled down what is a fascinating interview with one of my favourite authors, Dennis Wheatley, about the occult. And so I thought I'd leave you with that this week. This is all about the night of the 30th of April, which is a traditional night for black magic. But here's Dennis Wheatley, the author, the British author, and also who's involved in the Second World War as a deception planner in Whitehall, talking about his views of this spooky subject.
The devil was part of the original creation, and if you believe in God, then you must believe in the devil. But of course, that's nothing to do with Christian religion at all. There are two influences. One for light, under which everything grows and blossoms, and one is darkness, in which everything decays and dies. And in any part of the world, within the year, the same hours of darkness and light supervene. And you have these two invisible influences striving for the soul of man. We don't know why, any more than we know what is eternity.
And you believe that light and darkness, right and left, good and evil, are two absolutely separate but equally powerful
warring powers. And the devil is only just a name for power of evil.
You referred just now to invisible influences. I'm perhaps a bit of a cynic, and I tend not to believe in these sort of things. Why do you believe in them?
Well, one invisible influence is, for example, the influence of the moon on the tides. There is good reason to suppose that all planets have an influence on us. Hypnotism, which has been proved again and again, telepathy, which is beyond dispute now, dowsing for water, they are invisible influences.
How did you first get involved in this interest?
Only because I was gassed in the First World War, so I had to give up tennis and all other outdoor sports, so I read enormously, and I read a great deal of fiction, but I also read accounts of Egyptology and all the ancient religions and so on, and became interested in that sort of thing. So when I had written three very successful thrillers, I was just simply looking round for a new form of excitement and so on, and it suddenly struck me, well, why not write a book about the black arts, Satanism? So I wrote The Devil Rides Out, and since then, although I've written 60 books, only 8 of my books have been about the occult, but they've all been very successful.
You say that today the powers of darkness in its eternal war, the power of darkness in its eternal war with the power of light, is threatening to come out on top. If this continues on an ever-increasing scale, the inevitable result will be a return to the brutal lawlessness, poverty, and insecurity of the Dark Ages. Do you really believe that about the modern
day? I do believe that. The violence and that sort of thing that's going on today is unbelievable, and the government are not controlling it. And that doesn't go only for this country. It's all over Europe and the United States worse than ever. And they've just got to take a line.
Well, give me an example of how the power of darkness, as you call it, is operating in this town, in this country today.
Well, there are said to be over 300 covens in this country. Covens, that is 13 people making up a coven of witches. And they're increasing every day, I suppose, because the two world wars have made great insecurity with young people, and they're looking for something, you must have something to cling on to, and they are tempted by these evil people, not necessarily people who have real power, but evil people, to come to these parties. We'll promise you want to marry a boss, all right, you come along on Tuesday, have a little fun and that sort of thing and so on. And that is where an immense amount of the dope pushing, that sort of thing, goes on, because witches and our sabbats have always used drugs.
Do you know, have you met modern witches?
When I first wrote my first book on black magic, before I wrote it, I took trouble to get an introduction to Aleister Crowley, to Rollo Ahmed, to Harry Price, Montague Summers, all of whom were top boys in that line. And I used to have them to lunch and dinner and talk to them. I had many conversations, but I've never dabbled in it myself, because I am absolutely certain no good can come of it. And you'll probably get so interested in this thing, but you'll neglect your wife, you'll neglect your job, and there it is. If you're weak-minded, you can end up in a loony bin.
I wonder if you don't perhaps sometimes feel a sense of responsibility yourself for the state of affairs, because there is no doubt your books sell in absolutely fabulous numbers. Are you catering for the very thing that you are against?
I can't believe that, because in every book I write, I always give a warning that this thing is evil and no good can ever come to anybody who dabbles in it.
You haven't quite answered my question. Aren't you feeding the curiosity that is creating this evil?
No, I don't. I feel that by warning people, so many people are drawn into this thing, and I feel that I at least am in warning them. It's not a good thing to do.
Do you think they might ever strike at you?
No, I have complete confidence in my own protection, because they can only strike at people who are afraid and who believe that they can be harmed. And I don't. I don't say that I'm a particularly good person, but I believe that I'm on the right side. And I believe the powers of light will protect me from anything that anybody could ever attempt about me.
But you're fearful the powers of darkness may take us over.
I think that civilization is disintegrating. Unless somebody takes a pull, things are getting worse and worse every year.
Well, a bit of a doom merchant, but a great novelist, a great author, and also a great help to Britain during the Second World War. That's Dennis Wheatley, and played that really sort of to commemorate Walpurgisnacht on the 30th of April, and also really a state of a kind of annoyance that the BBC should pull that from their website. That's not the only thing that's been pulled, Martin, is it? There was a documentary supposed to be shown that's also been pulled.
Yeah, it was a documentary about the history of Jerusalem. And I think it's presumably from pressure from Israeli interests that it's not been shown. It was actually scheduled to be shown this week.
What was the content of it? What was that going
to be? Well, basically, what it was arguing was that the whole Zionist narrative is that the Jews were expelled by the Romans from Palestine in 70 AD. They dispersed around the world, and then at the end of a long story, they come back in the 1940s and set up their state. But what the documentary is pointing out is that people didn't in fact get dispersed, and they probably dispersed to Islam and became Palestinian.
Interesting you say that, because exactly the same article on the Alan Hart website. He's a former BBC Panorama producer, and also he was on ITN. Time to sign off now. Typical topical Afro-tropical show next. You'll find this show online, thisweek.org.uk. Over now to Cyrus.
Community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.